next speaker is Dr. John Studenroth. I had the pleasure of knowing John for a number of years. We were up in Ithaca at Cornell together. John got his PhD at Cornell in plant psychology. Oh, it was pathology, right. Plant pathology. And then came to seminary, received his MDiv here at Biblical Theological Seminary, and is now pastor at a church in Kutztown, right by the University of Kutztown, and doing a great job among the students in the community at Kutztown as well. Dr. Studenroth's talk is The Glory of God as Revealed in the Microscope.
John. It's a pleasure to be with you this evening. Yes, plants have nervous systems and they react, so we could do plant psychology. But mine was plant pathology, diseases of plants and crops, and in particular that led me into the whole realm of viruses, and we'll conclude tonight's lecture on that note. You'll see I've outlined the topic in four broad areas. We want to look at the glory of God as revealed in the single cell, both prokaryotic and eukaryotic, for those of you who already are into biology. Photosynthesis, that process whereby sunlight is converted into sugars. The ribosome, a little organelle, which we'll be introducing shortly, and the virus. There's a scripture verse in Proverbs. It's a favorite of mine. It simply says this. It's Proverbs 25:2, and I'm reading from the New American Standard. It says, "It is the glory of God to conceal a matter, but the glory of kings is to search out a matter." I used that particular verse in the frontispiece of my PhD dissertation at Cornell in 1979, and then I had a footnote where it says the glory of kings. I put a footnote on the word kings and said, scientists who receive federal grants. Back in the days of Solomon, there was no National Science Foundation in ancient Israel that we're aware of, and the only people who had the leisure time and the financial backing to do plant pathology, if you will, or any natural sciences, were the kings. And indeed they did. We read about Solomon in Kings and Chronicles, and he studied the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He studied birds and plants. He was the all-around Renaissance man. Wrote poetry and songs and did a lot. Architect. But one of the things that Solomon evidently delighted in was elucidating what God had placed in nature. And that's what science is all about. The natural sciences is really summarized in the first half of that verse. It is the glory of God to conceal a matter. Well, I should say both halves. That's the first half. The second half, the glory of kings is to search out a matter. That is the enterprise, the modern scientific enterprise. It was John Kepler in the 1600s, the astronomer who had elucidated the elliptical patterns of the planets, their elliptical orbits, who made the comment, "I think thy thoughts after thee, O God." And that's what we're doing in the scientific enterprise. We are simply thinking God's thoughts after him. Now, the modern scientific enterprise, by and large, does not give God any credit. We pat each other on the back and we issue Nobel Prizes and we say how marvelous that Dr. So-and-so has figured out the Calvin cycle of photosynthesis and he gets a Nobel Prize. How wonderful that Watson and Crick elucidated the double helical structure of DNA and they get a Nobel Prize. But if you're honest about it, the engineer, the architect, the physicist, as we saw in the introduction, is God himself. Starting then tonight with the glory of the single cell, I'm going to let you know that you consist of cells, if you didn't know that, about 100 trillion of them, perhaps, if you believe Carl Sagan. The lowest forms of life that we know and the highest forms of life consist of cells. Indeed, this is called the cell theory. It's one of the pillar stones of modern biology, that living things consist of cells. Bacteria and other very simple organisms are sometimes referred to as prokaryotic cells. Prokaryotic means before the nucleus. Pro before karyotic, referring to a nucleus. Cells that do not have a true nucleus are referred to in biology as prokaryotic. All the higher organisms, starting in the Cambrian explosion and beyond, and indeed some before the Cambrian explosion in the fossil record, may have been what we call eukaryotic. I won't repeat the second half, I'll just put a little sign there, EU, and then the same root word, karyotic. U meaning good or true. All organisms that have a true nucleus, a nucleus that has a membrane around it, a nuclear membrane. It's a discrete organelle in itself, containing chromosomes. Human beings are eukaryotic. Most of the things that we think about that we can see with the naked eye, plant or animal life, would be eukaryotic. Prokaryotic, you can think bacteria tonight. That's the simplest way to remember it. Prokaryotic, microscopic, bacteria. Eukaryotic, anything more complex than that. Early biologists viewed the cell as just a membrane containing some jelly, and they called the jelly protoplasm. Indeed, the word cell comes from a man named Robert Hooke, who, using a very primitive microscope, was looking at some dead cork cells. He didn't realize what he had, but he saw all these little boxes, and he said, huh, they look like the cells of a monastery, the rooms in a monastery, so he called them cell. So you see, we already have a theological foundation to the subject. So for a long time, there was that rather gross oversimplification. Other scientists with these crude microscopes began to notice that they weren't empty little boxes like Robert Hooke's, but that they had some kind of jelly in them. And they said, well, that's the protoplasm. And then these membranes, or walls in the case of plants like cork, rigid walls, are the cell wall. It didn't take too long until we began to distinguish a rather important structure in cells, which became known as the nucleus. And then this distinction, you know, before the nucleus and those things that have a true nucleus. But it's with each year that goes by, we are adding to our knowledge of the internal structure of cells, we find they are marvelously complex. There's far more than a nucleus. And so the early terminology of nucleus and protoplasm or cytoplasm, just an idea of a jelly, was hopelessly oversimplified. There is so much that is happening in this jelly. Today we know, as we heard in the introduction, that one living cell could be compared quite fairly, I believe, to a modern city, in the sense that a cell has a modern transportation system. It has power plants. It has factories for making needed materials. It has packaging plants, even a postal service, if you will, for shipping things to marked designations. And best of all, a city hall with all kinds of records and documents that govern the functioning of the entire cell. In city hall, as a matter of fact, there are duplicate sets of blueprints, two blueprints for every structure in this entire city. Your cells, as you sit here this evening, every cell, from the tip of your toe to the tip of your nose, has a double set of blueprints, not just to govern that cell, but a double set of blueprints that governs everything about you, from the enzymes in your liver, to the color of your eyes, to the shape of your nose, to the circuits in your brain. Every cell of your 1 trillion to 100 trillion, there's some give or take on how many cells exactly in the human body, but let's take Carl Sagan's number, 100 trillion. Every one of those cells, with the exception of your red blood cells, has a nucleus, and in the nucleus, a double set of blueprints governing everything about you, structurally and functionally. And even, I think it would be fair to say, bearing on your personality and a few of your traits. You may indeed have inherited your father's temper to some extent, some biological basis for that. Carl Sagan, as was noted in that introduction, in Encyclopedia Britannica back in 1974, estimated the information content of a prokaryotic cell, a bacterial cell, as being around 10 to the 12th bits. Base number 10, exponent 12. Those of you who are not mathematicians, if you're going to write that number out, you'd have to add 12 zeros after this and put all the commas in there, and you would have this number, 100 trillion pieces of information just in a bacterial cell. I have read other sources, and Carl Sagan may have been shooting a little bit high, but not that high. We certainly reduce it maybe by 1,000 or 10,000. We're still dealing with a very large number of the bits of information in a bacterial cell. And it's certainly going to be true for a human cell. More information than that, I'm sure, in the nucleus of any human or higher animal cell. And as we learned in that introduction, that's comparable then to 100 million pages of Encyclopedia Britannica. And I don't know if you caught that in those slides, but that translates into 4,000 sets of Britannica. So one cell in its nucleus, and possibly even a bacterial cell, has what's comparable to 4,000 sets of Britannica, all different. We're not talking about 4,000 sets of Britannica, all the same set, and so you got replication 4,000 times, the same articles. No, we're talking about the amount of information that would be in 4,000 sets if the sets were entirely different from each other. You know how big Britannica is, right? And you multiply that times 4,000, you got a lot of books. And that's the kind of information content that we have lurking in the nucleus of a rather simple cell. If you took the DNA out of a human cell and just stretched it out, because it is a linear molecule made up of nucleotides and you know, could be stretched out like a thin thread, it would be 550 times finer than the finest spider web that we know, and 6 feet long. 6 feet, 550 times finer than the finest spider web, a string of information written in a chemical language that governs all these things. What's fascinating to me is the way God has designed not only this information content, but how we access it, how the body knows to find what I call the right recipe in the cookbook. I like to think of our chromosomes, and the human cell has 46 of them, 23 different chromosomes times two. Remember I said you have a double set of blueprints in every cell of your body. So if you were to take a human cell under the microscope, look at that nucleus, you'd find 46 chromosomes, 23 different cookbooks times two, backup reserve system. And in there, you find all the recipes, if you will, to cook all the proteins that go into the functioning of the human body. Let's suppose you ladies are in the kitchen working with a paring knife, you're peeling vegetables, and you suddenly slip and you slash your finger, and you say, oh no, I cut my finger, and you wash it off, maybe you put a Band-Aid on it, knowing full well that within a week, it'll be quite healed. Instantly, having made that slash through the skin and into the lower tissues of the finger, the body senses what you've done, says, you jerk, and begins to go to work, synthesizing the proteins needed to mend the wound. White blood cells there to fight any infection, and I'm oversimplifying. It's a very complex, and I'm sure we don't even know half of what goes on. But one thing we do know is that all the information is right there in the nuclei of all those adjacent cells to that gash that know how to mend that within a week and regrow the skin, and everything's fine. But all the information that's in the nuclei of those cells adjacent to the gash also tells about the enzymes in your liver, the circuits in your brain, and the complete structure of your eyeballs. Have you ever wondered, now that you know that? You probably haven't had time to wonder yet, but you can wonder after I tell you I've wondered about this. Why doesn't an eyeball grow right there? You've just cut this, the cells kick into action, the photocopy machines come on, the DNA is being photocopied into RNA, which I'll go over in a little bit, the RNA is made into protein, and everything's right there to grow an eyeball or an ear. What prevents it from calling on the wrong information, growing the wrong structure at that point? That is called differentiation by biologists, and it's a very complex subject and something we know very little about. I said we have cookbooks, and the cookbooks are kept in the nucleus. They are on closed reserve. All you who use libraries, you know what it means when a book's on closed reserve. You got to sit in that room and read it. You can't take it home. In the nucleus of your cells are these 46 cookbooks that are never allowed out of the nucleus. The nucleus is the library. The individuals, if you will, who read the books and cook the recipes are called ribosomes. And in a few moments when we have the overheads, I'll show you some of these structures. But I just want you to get a kind of a metaphor, an allegory in your mind tonight as we go into this, that we're going to be looking at cookbooks and we're going to be looking at cooks. The cooks use the cookbooks and they're going to be cooking the recipes. But they're not allowed to take the cookbooks out into the cell where they need them. All the activity occurs outside the nucleus in the cytoplasm. That's where proteins are synthesized. That's where recipes are literally cooked. If the cooks can't get the cookbooks out. And interestingly enough, the ribosomes are never allowed into the nucleus. So the cooks cannot get into the library. I mean, here's a book on closed reserve and you can't get in. That used to happen here at Biblical. I remember that now. We had a test the next day. The library was locked and dark and the book he wanted was in there and you couldn't get to it. So you'd call up Jim Packle and he'd come out with his key and let you in. But in this case, you can't get into the library to get to the recipes and the cookbooks are not allowed out. The problem is solved with a very interesting photocopy mechanism, as I like to refer to it. You photocopy the recipes into something called messenger RNA. The cookbooks are written in a chemical language called DNA, and the cookbooks are then photocopied, and a copy is made into lowercase mRNA, and the little letter M stands for messenger, one of three types of RNA. Messenger RNA is then permitted out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm surrounding it. The little ribosomes can read it, act upon it, and they take amino acids and make proteins. Now, Dr. Sagan continues to look at this, and he thinks about these 46 cookbooks, and he thinks about what's called a mutation. A mutation is when you glitch one letter in a recipe. You could take out one nucleotide and change it in a DNA strand. That's obviously going to then affect the photocopy into the RNA and ultimately affect the recipe, and therefore ultimately affect the structure of the protein. And you can monkey around with all these possible DNA nucleotides, and so the letters, incidentally, in the alphabet of this chemical language are four. We have 26 in the English alphabet. This has four. And so Carl Sagan sat there and sort of took his pencil and his calculator out and thought about, okay, how many possible varieties of mutation are there in human chromosomes? And this is the number he came up with. The base 4 is raised to the exponent 4 times 10 to the ninth. That means the exponent alone has to have 9 zeros after it, and then that's how you're going to multiply 4 together. Most of us are more familiar with working to base 10, so I'll translate that. 10 to the 2.4 times 10 to the ninth. That's base 10. If you take 2.4 and put move the decimal point over 9 places, so you have some very large number. That's just the exponent. And then you have to take 10 and multiply it by itself that many times. It's an inconceivably large number of different recipes, how you can alter the human being slightly, altering the proteins. That's the number of possible human beings, I guess you could say. Just to give you an idea how big a number that is, scientists estimate that the number of elementary particles in the entire universe, that would be a proton and electron basically forming a hydrogen atom, the number of these elementary particles in the entire physical universe is 10 to the 80th. That means 10 multiplied by itself 80 times. This is a far larger number. We're talking here in the order of trillions. Multiplying 10 to the other trillion times to try to reach the number of possible different configurations of the human being. Carl Sagan, after meditating on this for a while, says that most of these possible sequences of nucleotides to make different kinds of human beings would lead to complete biological malfunction. I mean, you wouldn't live. Your enzymes simply wouldn't work properly. He then concludes with this sentence, "Thus, a human being is an extraordinarily improbable object." He's right. By random processes, to come to what we call the Homo sapiens sapiens, the human being, is an extremely improbable conclusion. Okay, let me show you some overheads tonight of... Uh-oh, am I plugged in? Ah, we got it here. Okay, multiple switch mechanism here. This is an artist's conception of a generic animal or human cell. You can see that it's not just jelly, but there's a lot going on there. And I just want to point out a few of the major organelles. We're not going to have a complete cell cytology course here tonight. But this large object in the center is the nucleus, sort of a sphere. The convoluted membrane that emanates away from the nucleus and is ramifying through the cytoplasm is known as the endoplasmic reticulum. It serves a number of purposes. It helps to compartmentalize the cytoplasm into different units so that different functions can be happening in little rooms, if you will. It's like putting partitions up to divide one room into several classrooms. And this helps the ribosomes to be producing different chemicals in different little compartments. Sprinkled all over those partitions, if you will, are the ribosomes. So every little speck looks like little specks of black pepper. Each speck, 1/1000th of an inch in diameter, is a ribosome. The entire cell, incidentally, is about 1/2500th of an inch in diameter. That's an average. Cells vary greatly in their size, but if you're going to get some kind of average idea, 2,500 cells to the inch, but 1,000,000 ribosomes to the inch. The Golgi body that's shown up here is the packaging plant. It takes chemicals produced by ribosomes on endoplasmic reticulum, packages them into little vesicles that can be shipped either somewhere else in the cell or to other cells. Your pancreas produces insulin. The Golgi bodies would package that insulin into little vesicles, ship it away from the pancreas to other parts of the body that require it. The mitochondria, which one of those is shown up top here. Lay my pen on it. That's mitochondrion. That's the little blast furnace. It takes the food that you eat, breaks it down into glucose, blood sugar. The glucose is then burned, you might say, in that mitochondrion. Not at a very high temperature. Thanks to enzymes, we can keep it at 98.6, and you don't have to sit there and really cook. But it uses oxygen and gives off carbon dioxide. And so as you sit here breathing tonight, you breathe in oxygen and basically breathe out carbon dioxide, in a simplified description. You are simply the culmination of your 100 trillion cells, each having anywhere from maybe 10 to 100 mitochondria in them. You are the combined inhalation and exhalation of all your mitochondria. You breathe in, you're supplying trillions of mitochondria with their oxygen. And you breathe out, you're releasing trillions of mitochondria worth of carbon dioxide. And your energy then comes from that process. A little chemical called ATP, some of you may have heard of that if you had a biology course, adenosine triphosphate, is produced in the mitochondria, shipped throughout the cell, and governs and supplies energy for all the other functions that are going on, including those ribosomes that are trying to make your proteins. I won't go into any of the others. There's more things we could talk about, but I think you get the idea. There's a lot happening. It's a very busy little place, and things are being shipped around, and work is being performed, and information is turning into structure and function. I just want to boggle your mind a little bit, if I may, by saying, look at the wrapper. Just look at the wrapper. It looks like a piece of plastic wrap that kind of keeps this whole thing wrapped together. It's called the cellular membrane, a plasma membrane. You'll see it labeled the top term up there, cell membrane, the very top description. Let's take a closer look at that. It's not plastic wrap, folks. God has interesting ways of making even the wrapper. This top illustration is a true electromicrograph where they're trying to show the double lipid layer. That's kind of hard to figure out, so let's look at the artist's conception, which makes a little more sense. All membranes in biology are lipid bilayers. We have lipid molecules that the head is, if I can get this straight now, hydrophilic. That is, the heads of these molecules love water. The tails hate water. They're hydrophobic. Indeed, they speak here, hydrophilic endoprotein, hydrophobic endoprotein. That's also true of all these little white balls. These little lipids have a hydrophobic and a hydrophilic end, which means they instantly line up. If you put this particular type of lipid into water, it will line up and form a membrane. You say, ah, see how easy evolution is? I mean, you just dump lipids in water, membrane, snaz. You know, thermodynamically, just forms. Well, you begin to study these membranes, and you find embedded in them are proteins and carbohydrates, and all kinds of interesting things are happening. And they are what determine what gets into a cell and what gets out of a cell. It's not just random diffusion. There's active transport. There's certain things that are allowed in. Other things are pumped out. And you begin to realize, there's quite a bit going on here. Then you meet a guy like Dr. Bloom, who you'll be hearing from later this weekend. And you find out he has his whole PhD thesis on membranes of red blood cells, what were called the ghosts of red blood cells. The hemoglobin and the contents are dumped out, and you're left just with the wrapper. And so he sits there with laser beams, and being a biophysicist, he knows twice as much as I do. He knows all the biology I know, plus a whole bunch of physics that I don't know. And he sat there at Cornell University studying for years and writing this big fat tome for his dissertation on just one type of membrane, red blood cell membranes. And then you say, well, now we know everything. John knows everything there is to know about membranes, right? Well, not exactly. His advisor, as far as I know, is still living and still at Cornell. And Dr. Webb continues to graduate students like John Bloom each year, probably at least one a year, writing a big dissertation on some other aspect of cell membranes. And that's one university. There's other universities in this country and universities around the world where men simply study membranes. And they're all writing big fat books, and they're all getting PhDs and then going out and finding jobs. Just membranes, folks. There is so much going on in these membranes that you can spend the rest of your life just studying membranes. Gives you an idea of what's happening in the living cell. I'm going to move on now because I'm a botanist at heart. I love plants. We're going to move away from that animal-human cell. We're going to get down to the real nitty-gritty nuts and bolts, plants. And that moves us into our second topic, photosynthesis. We're going to look both structurally and chemically tonight at the glory of God as revealed in a process known as photo, meaning light, synthesis, meaning production, in this case, of organic molecules, using the energy of light. What I'm illustrating at the top of this picture is a leaf. We go out and we pick a green leaf. We take our little disc borer and we cut a piece of a leaf out. That little black circle illustrates what we're cutting out of a leaf. And if we could look at it three-dimensionally with a microscope, we would see an upper epidermis, a lower epidermis, a waxy layer called a cuticle, nice rows of cells called palisade mesophyll, kind of more loosely packed, more globular cells called spongy mesophyll, conducting tissues running through the leaf for food and water called phloem and xylem, and little stoma, which are little, the Greek word for mouth, meaning a little opening or pore that has guard cells and can open and close to control the rate of transfusion of air in and out of the leaf. The leaf needs the carbon dioxide and emits the oxygen. And so it has to regulate how much it opens. It has to be careful not to open too much and dehydrate on a hot day. So there's a lot of fine-tuning going on in the life of the leaf, and that's what they're illustrating here with guard cells and gases going in and out. What we want to do this evening is zero in on one spongy mesophyll cell. We're going to reach in and just remove one spongy mesophyll cell, and those little black spots there are chloroplasts. A mesophyll cell in a green leaf has chloroplasts, and that's the active site. That's where the action's at in terms of photosynthesis. Let me just put another illustration up here. It's a little more colorful. Here the chloroplasts are green in this picture. Again, the cuticle, the palisade cells, the vein coming through, transporting materials, the spongy mesophyll, the lower cuticle, the guard cells, the stoma. If we take one such cell now, and we put it under a microscope, and we're going to have to shift to an electron microscope at this point to multiply it 14,000 times. The top picture, which is black and white, gives you the true electron, transmission electron picture. A very thin slice has been taken through a plant cell. We're going to work from the more colorful artist's reconstruction so we can better understand what we're looking at. Plant cells, unlike the animal and human cells, have a rigid cell wall that gives them a real rigid shape. That's made of cellulose. Internally, they have a large wasteland. Unlike animal cells, which may have a small vacuole, plants typically have a very large vacuole, a real toxic dump, if you will. Around the edge of that is the cytoplasm, often pressed up against the wall, and very conspicuous, in addition to the one nucleus, which is kind of smooshed up here, are these green chloroplasts. They predominate in a cell like this, and we can see right there six of them in that particular cell. We're going to go a step deeper. Yes, there's ribosomes, lots of ribosomes in here, and they're doing their thing just like they did in the plant or in the human or animal cell. But we're going to take one chloroplast tonight, and we want to go down still deeper. This is a little bit like Alice in Wonderland going through the keyhole. We're going to go down, down, down into the ultrastructure of what's happening here. One chloroplast now, one green speck has been removed. Again, the black and white illustrates the true transmission electron micrograph. This diagram gives us more of the structure. You notice where it says grana. That's referring to a whole stack of something here. Looks like a stack of pancakes, perhaps, that you just kind of cut through with a knife. Or maybe you look at like a stack of pennies or nickels. This stack of disks, each disk is called a granum, and the total stack called grana. Also, one disk can be called a thylakoid. I love analogies, metaphors, allegories. So tonight, our allegory is going to be pancakes. These are pancakes, folks. Just loaded with pancakes, okay? Stacks and stacks of pancakes. Every thylakoid is one pancake, and a stack of pancakes is grana. Everybody with me? Got the terminology? Okay. The stroma is the maple syrup all around them, okay? A chloroplast, then. We're going to view it as a stacks and stacks and stacks of pancakes with stroma syrup all around them. Let's take a simplified overview here just to remember where we're at. We started with a plant cell that had a rigid wall and a big vacuole and a nucleus. We took out one chloroplast. If we could see it three-dimensionally and cut into the chloroplast, we see our stacks of pancakes. They're only showing three stacks here, obviously many more than three. Here is an interesting view of the pancakes. You see the pancakes do have some interconnections. Those membranes are interlaced somewhat. What we're going to do next is we're going to cut open one pancake and look inside. So that's what I'm showing here. When it says thylakoid membrane, there's an interior. There's a cavity inside each disc. And we want to see what's inside this hollow pancake. So moving down with Alice into Wonderland here. Here is one pancake. You no longer can use an electron microscope. We're getting beyond the resolution of that. But we can, from many other techniques, scientists can elucidate what's happening. And there's a high measure of agreement among scientists that this is what's happening inside a pancake. A thylakoid space, the internal cavity, is a hydrogen reservoir. If you remember that elementary chemistry from high school, as you increase hydrogen ion concentration, what do you do to pH? Does anybody remember? pH goes down. The number goes down. The acidity goes up. Something, the lower the pH, the more acid something is. Anybody drinking a Coke or a Pepsi tonight, it's probably pH of 3. It's bad. It's hard on your teeth. It's hard on your stomach. Your stomach's used to acid, though, because you're secreting a lot. But it's nasty stuff. And that's what's happening here. We're making an acid battery. This plant cell inside this one thylakoid is pumping hydrogen in and concentrating it. Where does it get the energy to do that? You can't concentrate something without energy. Aha, that's where the light comes in. You see that word photon up there? Photons are particles of light. As the sunlight hits the membrane of the thylakoid, it somehow produces the energy, yields the energy that's required to pump up the battery. Sunlight. You can trace everything back to sunlight. And what is the gateway that allows the energy of the sun to get into plants and into animals and into us? Through the food chain as we eat different organisms, down, back down to the grass. Photosynthesis. It all happens right here in the thylakoid membrane as the hydrogen leaks out of this little battery and drives the mechanism of the CFO-CF1 complex ATP synthetase, which is an enzyme, a large protein. ATP is produced. The Lord has a sense of humor, and he has a few exceptions to this. I would say 99.999% of life depends on this. And just lest we get arrogant and think we've got it all figured out, the Lord made some chemosynthetic bacteria over here that have another way of doing it. But they don't affect us. None of you had chemosynthetic bacteria for supper tonight. It's not part of the food chain. It's kind of a little loop off to the side. So yes, the humor people, we can say, yeah, there's some life that doesn't require this. But everything you and I are familiar with, from the lettuce in your salad to the hamburger in your bun, and the wheat that went into the bun, did this, came ultimately from that. Photosynthesis is a very important subject, for that reason, does get funding. And at Cornell University, there was a man named Andre Jagendorf, who's world-renowned, internationally famous, because he's the guy that figured this out. He figured out the chemiosmotic hypothesis in thylakoids. He's the guy that said, hey, there's an acid battery forming here, and as it leaks out, it's driving this process. See, whoopee. I just want you to know that he graduates graduate students every year at Cornell. And they write big, fat dissertations. And they're in plant physiology. And they study, they stand on his shoulders, and they elucidate more of this. There's enough information in one thylakoid, and this man's always grinding up spinach. I just have to laugh. He's always taking spinach leaves and running them through a meat grinder and taking the green juice and ultracentrifuging it, taking this extract and analyzing this and writing paper after paper, year after year, scholarly publication after scholarly publication, and overseeing graduate student after graduate student. He writes a big fat book called a PhD thesis dissertation and goes off and finds a job somewhere in some university or some agricultural substation somewhere in the world and makes a living and continues working in this area. Do you get an idea how much engineering we have here? Just in one thylakoid that can keep men working so hard to figure it out. Let's just take a quick overview again. We started with our plant cell. We took out a chloroplast. We cut it open. We saw the stacks of pancakes. We took one pancake. We looked inside of it. Found out there's a lot of interesting things going on. And I didn't even tell you about photosystems yet. Photosystems are what's happening in the membrane of the thylakoid as those photons of light are striking them. They're what take the photons and turn them into energy that can eventually charge up the acid battery. That's a whole separate complexity in itself. And then this funny looking thing here is the pigment, the chlorophyll molecule. All the photosystems contain maybe 400 chlorophyll molecules per photosystem. And you've probably heard of chlorophyll. That's the green pigment that makes green plants green. And they're very important in this whole process. Let me just go a little bit deeper with you, if I haven't already driven you crazy. Here is one chlorophyll molecule. Millions and millions of them per plant cell, 400 per photosystem in one thylakoid membrane, and many photosystems in a thylakoid membrane. But the structure, which I can't completely, well, that's pretty well on there. You have a porphyrin ring at the top, very analogous to hemoglobin, but in this case, a magnesium atom, not iron, in the center, and a long tail called the phytol tail. The whole structure of this molecule is sort of like a frying pan or a skillet. And hundreds of them are packed together, nested like saucers, nested together. So these chlorophyll molecules in a photosystem are kind of tightly packed. A photon enters, strikes one chlorophyll molecule, gets it all excited, and it begins to vibrate and jiggle. And it's the magnesium atom that's most important in this excitement, if you will, this jiggling of the molecule. And as it jiggles, it can't help but bump the frying pan to the left and the one to the right, and they begin to jiggle. And the vibrations begin to move down the line until they hit one central chlorophyll molecule that, when it gets jiggled enough by all of the buddies getting hit by photons and passing the energy down the chain, finally gets so excited, it shoots off an electron. I mean, it just fires off an electron, sort of like shooting a little rocket into orbit. And when that happens, then you guys that are more into electrical engineering can appreciate this. We move out of my field, biology, into some kind of a combination of electricity and chemistry here. You have oxidation reduction potential in volts. Photosystem 1, photosystem 2, and this pigment P700 and P680 means there's different kinds of chlorophyll, chlorophyll A, chlorophyll B, that vibrate at slightly different frequencies. They absorb light at different wavelengths. But in any case, in photosystem 1, the electron gets shot off, and as it reaches a higher energy level, it begins to come back down again. It's very excited, but it begins to come back down through a very, very complicated series of chemical receptors and steps. What's this all about? What's happening? Well, a chemical called NADP+ is being reduced to something called NADPH. You say, oh, come on. Well, this is important. This is biochemistry. It, too, will help make ATP. Everything that we're looking at here tonight ultimately helps in this process of charging up these acid batteries and making ATP. Photosystem 1, having lost an electron, needs to have it replaced. That comes from photosystem 2. It gets excited. It shoots off an electron. It goes through a series of chemicals, work being done along the way, and resupplies the electron to photosystem 1. Well, now you have a problem. You lost an electron from photosystem 2. It's replaced from water. Water is split in this whole process. Oxygen is released. There's where the oxygen comes from in photosynthesis. Hydrogen's released. Electrons are supplied. Everything's well integrated. I'm not trying to blow you away tonight, but I'm just trying to get you to appreciate there's enough electrical engineering here to keep the engineers happy. There is enough chemistry here to keep the chemists happy. There's enough pure biology here to keep us biologists happy. There's enough biophysics here to keep the physicists happy. There's just everything you need to stay happy, okay? And if you can find the money, you can do research. Everything I've been looking at tonight is either in the dough of the pancake or the cavity of the pancake, which we call the thylakoid. Does anybody remember what the maple syrup was? What was the technical term for the maple syrup around the pancakes in the chloroplast? Stroma. And here's the stroma. It, too, is not some jelly. It's not just some sugar. It's not just some syrup. It's all kinds of sugars. It, interestingly enough, it is sugar, so my allegory is kind of right on. That stroma is very sweet, and here are some of the sugars that are in it. This Calvin cycle, as it's called, in which one sugar you start, it looks like a game board. Start here, you know, don't go to jail, don't pass go. You start here with 3-ribulose phosphate. You take 3 ATPs. Now you're suddenly seeing why ATP is important. This process of photosynthesis, which is now going to make sugars, uses a fair bit of ATP in order to make that final product, glucose. It's taking sunlight and carbon dioxide and water and making glucose. That's the process in a summary. But there's an awful lot going on in the stroma, and it's a cycle that doesn't just begin from scratch. You don't just begin with a carbon dioxide, begin sticking them together to get 6 of them and make a 6-carbon sugar. You begin with a 3-carbon sugar. You make 15 of these things here. You introduce 3 carbon dioxides at once. You make an 18, excuse me, that's a 15-carbon thing, 3 of these things, 3 pentoses. You add this to make 18 carbons worth, and then it breaks, and you come down to a 3-carbon molecule. You had 3 6-carbons, you end up with 6 3-carbon molecules. You add some more ATP, and you make 6 of these things. Then you make 6 of these things, and then you break a carbon off here, and you make 5 of these, and you end up back here again, and you say, where are we going? Well, you're making glucose in this whole process, and there's a point at which glucose comes out of the cycle, and carbon dioxide keeps going into the cycle. You notice it says here, glucose synthesis, little arrow, it's off the chart. But you take these little 3-carbon guys, and you put them together, and you make glucose molecules. This is called the Calvin cycle, and you better believe in the 1950s, when Melvin Calvin elucidated this, he deserved his Nobel Prize, and he got it. He got a Nobel Prize for his Calvin cycle. That's great. I think he did a lot of work. It was very, very clever experiments that he did. No credit given to God. You stop as a Christian, you stop and think, there's a lot of engineering going on here. There's a lot of chemical engineering. Did anybody set it up? Did anybody get this thing up and running? The secular scientist usually doesn't entertain that question too much. We just, as I said before, praise the men who found it. Photosynthesis. I've already tried to give you a feel for how complex it is. I just want to say that in 1945, a man named Eugene Rabinowitz said, I'm going to write a book that will summarize comprehensively everything we know about photosynthesis. What is the state of the art? What do we know about this subject? And he did. He started writing, and in 1956, he finished a 3-volume treatise called Photosynthesis. By the time it hit the library shelves and the universities, it was out of date. That's the trouble with science. It's hard to write a book and say what we know about something because by the time you publish it, 3 months have gone by and we've learned a whole bunch more. But I want you to realize this, that that's the last time anybody even tried to do that. When Eugene Rabinowitz said, I will write a 3-volume treatise that summarizes what we know, nobody after that ever said, I'll try that again. Why? Because we're learning so much, so fast, that you can't stay on top of the field of photosynthesis. Let me put it to you like this. Let's suppose you have a son or daughter. Some of you, I found out tonight, have some homeschool children here with you. Let's suppose one of your boys comes up to you and says, hey, this is neat. I'm going to be a botanist. Mom, mother says, okay, son, that's nice. It's a worthy calling. You can glorify God in that field. He says, but I'm going to be a plant physiologist. Be more specific. Okay, fine. But I'm going to study photosynthesis the rest of my life, Mom. Say, son, aren't you getting a little bit narrow-minded? When son gets to college, he goes to graduate school, he's going to have a rude awakening. He will find that he must choose one of 531 different chemical reactions in photosynthesis that we've found so far and spend the rest of his life on that if he's going to be a plant physiologist in the realm of photosynthesis. I have a friend at Harvard who's finishing a PhD there who went to an international congress of photosynthesis, and it was his roommate who went to it, came back and told him, he says, guess what? We're at that point, and this was about 3 years ago, we're at that point where you have to choose your reaction out of 531 reactions and focus on that. That means you go to the library and you ask the librarian to show you the journals of plant physiology and photosynthesis, and you'll find journals that are simply called photosynthesis. You'll find journals from Finland and Denmark and from America and from Canada and from Russia and from every country you can think of. Everybody in laboratories around the world studying photosynthesis and publishing scientific journals every month with all kinds of scholarly articles. You can't read all those journals, let alone all the books that are being published on this subject. So you've got to thumb through them to find your one chemical reaction, who's doing what with your chemical reaction out of the 531 chemical reactions. Do you have kind of a feeling for how much information is out there? How much structure? How much engineering? And somebody would say there's no engineer. I want to move on to our ribosome. and just show you here, again on overheads, what a ribosome looks like. Ribosome, you'll remember I said, was 1/1,000,000th of an inch in diameter. It's the cook. This is the little guy that makes the recipes by reading messenger RNA photocopies of DNA recipes out of the library. What does he look like? What's he made of? He looks like a two-globe snowman. He's got two balls. Now, this picture doesn't show him put together, but it says large subunit and small subunit. These two things, when they're put together, make a ribosome. What's inside a ribosome? Proteins and nucleic acid. Ribosome, ribosomal nucleic acid. Just to give you an idea, we're keeping things simple. This is a bacterial ribosome. These are smaller and simpler. The prokaryotic ribosomes are smaller and simpler than the eukaryotic. So what we're looking at here is simpler than what's in your body, or the average higher plant or animal. This is a bacterial ribosome. Its large subunit has a molecular weight of 1,600,000 atomic weight units, has 34 different proteins, some small, some large, but all very complex, ranging anywhere from 9,000 to around 28,000 atomic weight units or molecular weight units. Those are put together in a fashion and stitched together, so to speak, with RNA molecules. Ribosomal RNA, and the molecular weights are given there of 1,100,000 and 36,000 weight units. All of this is put together to make a very highly sophisticated, if you will, subunit that's going to have a very important task to do, which we'll see momentarily. The small subunit the same way, 21 different proteins and one RNA molecule putting it together. And these two subunits, when they're together, have the ability to actually ride along a messenger RNA recipe. Let me just summarize this by saying there's 55 different proteins in this, and that's important to remember. But here we have what's going on. The DNA in a cookbook unravels. When information is called for, some process, and we don't understand it yet, something comes in and says to that double helix of DNA, unwind at this point. Here's the recipe that I want. Here's the information I need. Unravel at that point and let some enzymes come in that will photocopy it. And that's what it says, RNA transcript. That is the brown ribbon coming off there is the photocopy. That gets out into the cytoplasm where the ribosome can work with it. And we have that moving out. This illustration doesn't show that, but take my word for it. It's like it gets out of the nucleus and into the cytoplasm. And what happens out there? Again, we're dealing at such small scale that we can't photograph this for you in any way you could appreciate it. So we have artist drawings of what we know to be going on. The two subunits of the ribosome are coming together here, the large subunit and the small. The messenger RNA photocopy of the recipe is in between the two units. Coming together are substances called amino acids. They are what build proteins. The ribosome is reading the recipe three letters at a time. It is saying, okay, I see here a GGC. That means I need the complementary code of CCG. Out here is a little twisted coat hanger looking gizmo. That little twisted coat hanger is another type of RNA called transfer RNA, and it has a special anticodon, we call it, of three letters that will perfectly match these letters, and it carries with it an amino acid. The ribosome says, in this case, for the UGU, I need an ACA, and I'm speaking teleologically, I realize. These things aren't talking, they're not doing this, but somehow the transfer RNA is brought into the ribosome. The cysteine, which is the next amino acid, will be fastened to the end of the glycine, and we have here a growing polypeptide. We have a growing protein chain. The ribosome is masterminding it. It's reading the recipe, selectively somehow signaling, calling out, if you will, saying this is the type of amino acid that's required by this three-letter word in the recipe. Cysteine, please. Glycine, please. Phenylalanine, please. Threonine, valine. It's calling for the amino acids in just the right sequence, putting them together with peptide bonds and moving along the recipe as it does so. So it's like a little train moving down the track, counting the ties on the track, and they're very important ties giving information, and it's calling it what's required. And proteins are being synthesized in this manner. What I want you to understand tonight is that as far as we know in biology, no proteins are produced in the living world without ribosomes. Even the lowliest bacterial cell uses ribosomes. You might say, how about the virus? That's true, viruses don't have any of these things, but then they depend on something that does. A virus is an obligate parasite. A virus just sits there like a lump in a log, does nothing, unless it can get into a cell that has ribosomes to make more of it. The virus has information, but it doesn't have any mechanism to do anything with it. It can't make proteins. And so a virus is dependent on a host cell. It's a parasite. It has to commandeer, hijack, if you will, something that does have ribosomes in order to have it replicated and made more of it. So there's nothing in the world that we're aware of that makes proteins in the living world, functional, useful proteins, except ribosomes. That's ground zero. You've got to have that to get this system up and running. Do you remember how many proteins I said were in the bacterial ribosome? 55 different. 34 in the top subunit, 21 in the bottom, for a total of 55 different, rather complicated, rather large proteins, all of which have a very demanding structure. You can't alter the amino acid sequence or you'll have a malfunctioning protein. Where did they come from? You see, what I'm saying is that you need 55 recipes to cook a cook. The cookbook has 55 recipes in it to make cooks. And where are you going to find your first cook to make cooks that can cook the recipes that are in the cookbook? It's a chicken egg type question. You have to have ribosomes to read the cookbooks to make the stuff that's in them, but you have to have 55 very sophisticated recipes cooked to get the cook to make anything else. And so how do you get the whole thing integrated and off the ground and up and running? Apart from an initial engineer that set the system up, I have no answer. I want to touch on viruses a little bit more now. I think I'm done with the overhead, so you can leave your lights on. Thank you. Because people from time to time have said, oh, the virus is more simple. The virus doesn't have all this cytoplasm and ribosomes and mitochondria and all this stuff. A virus is just a piece of DNA or RNA wrapped in a protein coat. Some have a little bit more. Occasionally there's an enzyme packaged in with them. But certainly no ribosomes, no real exciting biochemistry or engineering going on. So maybe, scientists from time to time have speculated, the virus is that missing link between non-life and life. If life is so complicated at the cellular level, could not the virus be that intermediate step? And I just want to briefly suggest tonight a couple of reasons why I think that is very laughable. One is, I've already pointed out, that a virus sitting on a bench, and indeed some viruses are fairly durable, tobacco mosaic virus, can be crystallized, set in a bottle, and put up on the shelf for 10 years and still be viable, be taken down, add some water, stir it up, rub it on a tobacco leaf with a little carborundum to make some wounds in the leaf, the virus gets into those cells, tobacco plant can get sick and develop the typical mottled appearance of tobacco mosaic virus. You go back and grind up the leaves and you find indeed that virus has multiplied greatly. But leave the bottle on the shelf, nothing's ever going to happen. Viruses don't get up and move, walk, they have no locomotion, none of the properties of life that biologists normally ascribe, irritability, growth by intussusception, these are all the technical terms as we try to define life, except one. Viruses multiply, they reproduce. But they don't do that, as I said, unless they get into a host cell that has all the machinery, like ribosomes, to do it for them. What they are nasty pieces of recipe, runaway recipes that do bad things. And cooks sometimes are too stupid to recognize them, and they cook up the evil brew, if you will. They get this recipe and they make it, and it takes over. And it says, shut down the normal machinery, quit doing what you normally do in this cell, and make millions and millions of me. And the ribosomes say, okay. And they make millions and millions of viruses. And after that happens in a number of your cells, and the viruses get from cell to cell, you begin to say, man, I got a sore throat. Guess what? Your ribosomes have been fooled, and they're making viruses. We're all more familiar with viruses because of the AIDS crisis, and that is a very sophisticated type of virus, a retrovirus. What's the possibility, and what would the selection pressure be, if you want to speak like an evolutionist, to simply produce a virus? How would that lead to anything? How do you get from a virus, which just sits there inert, to this complex integrated cell, which the virus demands and requires for its reproduction? It's a quantum leap. It's a multi-quantum leap from this virus with its DNA, RNA, and a protein coat to the completely functioning cell, which the virus has to have to do anything. So I just don't see how that's going to explain anything on an evolutionary scale. But the Lord, again, has a sense of humor. And in 1976, a man named Dr. Sanger was looking at a bacteriophage. Bacteriophage is a virus that infects bacteria. We're not the only ones that get sick. Bacteria can get sick. Indeed, one of my favorite cartoons I saw in the Sunday Fundies one time was Donald Duck. Donald Duck says to Uncle Ludwig, who's wearing his white lab coat with his test tubes, he comes in and says, Uncle Ludwig, what's a virus? And Uncle Ludwig says, oh, a teeny tiny thing. And Donald Duck says, oh, you mean a bug? And he says, no, much smaller than a bug. Donald Duck thinks for a while and he says, you mean a germ? And Uncle Ludwig says, no, much smaller than a germ. And then Uncle Ludwig, with a flash of insight, says, actually, he says, a virus is a germ's germ. That's a nice definition. It gives you kind of the physical scale and size, and it's true. There's a whole host of viruses that we call bacteriophage, and that sometimes is just abbreviated to the word phage, P-H-A-G-E. In 1976, Dr. Sanger was looking at one phage, if you will, of Escherichia coli, and I forget the name of this Farge now, they give them letter and number code names. But this particular Farge, he decided that he would sequence the DNA that was in it. It only was 4,000 nucleotides. That's not much. And he said, I will find out exactly what those nucleotides are. There's only four different ones to work from, and so it's going to be a pattern of adenine, adenine, guanine, cytosine, cytosine, guanine, thymine, adenine, thymine, 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 something like that. You're just going to have 4,000 letters based on a four-letter alphabet, and then you can go back and you can cut it into three-letter words. And he said, I'm going to figure out every protein that this little critter is coding for. I'm going to see what is this virus up to. What's really neat about this is the first time anybody, anywhere, had sequenced the DNA of a living organism. Or, if you want to call a virus a living organism, it's the first time we had sequenced the natural DNA of something. So Dr. Sanger, there was a lot of work. The techniques were clumsy in those days. We have highly refined the methods since then, but it was another Nobel Prize type thing. It was a marvelous piece of work, and you should see all the articles that cite it now. People publishing in this field go back and quote Dr. Sanger, 1976, the DNA sequence of this particular bacteriophage. Dr. Sanger did all his hard homework. He figured out the little words that these things were, what the amino acids would be. He figured out where the protein was. Part of it's the coat protein, some other enzyme. And then he kind of took a double take, because what he discovered was happening is that as this was being Xeroxed or photocopied into the messenger RNA, and as the ribosome with its two subunits was coming along reading the messenger RNA, he noticed that what was going on is that a protein would be produced, the ribosome would move the entire length of the messenger RNA, get off, come back and get back on, move over one letter, and reconnect here. Instead of reading AAG, it would now read AGC, CGT, ATT. And it reread the recipe, phase shifted one nucleotide over, and made a whole different protein. And it was a good protein. It was a functional protein. It was a necessary protein. And Dr. Sanger is looking at that and saying, that never happens in biology. We call that a mutation. In biology, it's called a frame shift mutation. If it's some ultraviolet light comes in from outer space, which can happen, and zaps off a nucleotide, we call that a deletion. The nucleotide's been removed. The ribosome gets confused. It starts reading at the wrong point, and it makes protein garbage. I mean, you can demonstrate this in the laboratory over and over again. If you do a frame shift mutation, meaning you're shifting the frame of reading your words, you get garbage. You get a malfunctioning, totally useless protein. And suddenly, Dr. Sanger saw a naturally occurring frame shift mutation that was good. It was producing something that was important. And I want to try to illustrate to you tonight what that means in terms of information content by simply taking an English sentence with three-letter words and doing a frame shift mutation. And I think you'll appreciate why Dr. Sanger just couldn't believe what he was seeing, nor could the world. When the article was published in Nature, I'd like to say you could hear a pin drop in the scientific community. There's times in scientific research where the whole scientific world sort of goes, oh, I can't believe what we're looking at. I can't believe what we're looking at. But it's there, so I guess it must be. And then we sort of go on our way. It's almost like you reharden your heart. You say, oh, it's really there. It's really happening. It must be there. So let's go on. In English, if we were to take three-letter words, the boy saw the cat run. And we take that six-word, 18-letter English sentence and do a frame shift mutation. The ribosome gets on down, misses the T, and goes this way. Heb, ois, A-W-T, out, H-E-C, heck, A-T-R, atter, U-N, something. I challenge you tonight after this seminar, or tomorrow when you get home, ladies, take your Betty Crocker cookbook off the shelf. Take any recipe you want. Men, take any novel, or take your Bible. Take any book you want, concordance, commentary. Take a paragraph and frame shift mutation it, and see if you get one word. And now realize you'll be dealing with more than three-letter words. You'll have four, five, six-letter words. But just frame shift mutation one letter and recut the words and see if you can find one meaningful English word. You might generate one once in a while. But a sentence? A paragraph? And in this case, a volume of Encyclopedia Britannica? Can you imagine a book in which the entire book is so coded that if you recut the words one letter over, you have an entirely different book, a whole different volume of Britannica superimposed on the first volume? Anybody here in defense, intelligence, military defense, work for the CIA, and you're allowed to admit it? We would love to do this kind of thing in the military. Can you imagine the kinds of codes, people that work in this field of cryptography, if they could have a novel that you give to the soldier, and it's this racy novel he's reading along, but when it comes time to attack the enemy, you frame shift it, and it's got all your directions. So he's sitting there with his paperback reading it. Nobody would suspect in the world. It's just a novel. You can read it for yourself. But he knows to frame shift all the words, one letter. And there's the directions, what to do when war breaks out. Ooh, neat. We can't do it. The human mind can apprehend that kind of intelligence, but we can't comprehend it, nor can we duplicate it. We can't reproduce it. We just sit there drooling, looking at it, saying, I can't believe the kind of intelligence I'm looking at here. They can take two protein recipes and put them on top of each other, and they both make sense, and they both fold together right, and they both are enzymes, and they both do something. God did it, and he stuck it in the virus. He said, virus is your evolutionary first step, huh? The least amount of intelligence, the least amount of engineering. You're going to bootstrap from a virus to a cell. Okay, look at this. And you just said, I can't believe it. The virus is doing this. I hope you see tonight that the Lord's wisdom is revealed in a way that should humble men. It should bring them to their knees. It should cause them to worship the God of the universe. Romans 1:20 says that men are without excuse because the attributes of God are screaming at them. And the deeper they go, the louder they scream. And what's exciting about living in this day and age is that all the science that we sometimes fear drives us away from faith. Well, I have a little saying, the best way to flee from science is to flee to it. You probably heard that about God. What's the best way to flee from God's wrath? How do you flee from the holy God? Flee to him. Come to him. Confess your sins. Repent. Turn to him. What's the best way to flee from all the dangers of science? Just flee to science. Tell your students to study their science. They don't have to study all the interpretations and the wrong conclusions. Just study the real raw material. And you'll come out with a deep, settled faith in a wise creator who is demonstrating his power, his wisdom in this universe. Thank you for your attention.